FOMO.
70% of people are not happy with their work. That's 100 million people, okay? So that's 2 million people, you know, I mean, that's 2 million people a week who are going to say, I'm unhappy. Like, that's an astonishing number of things. Yeah, that's just in the U.S., exactly. And internationally, we see similar trends. Okay, now what are you going to do? Okay, so what I'm advocating is that you do what the people who find happy, you know, who are happy, which is you start asking yourself what would make you happy.
I'm Patrick J. McGinnis, and I coined the term FOMO. That's short for fear of missing out, and it's why some people end up following the crowd when they should be blazing a trail of their own. But if you want to achieve greatness in business and life, you've got to break free. Come on, I'll show you how. This is FOMO Sapiens, where we explore how entrepreneurial thinkers find the inspiration and the courage to build exceptional lives. Welcome to another episode of FOMO Sapiens, the show for entrepreneurial thinkers. I'm your host, Patrick J. McGinnis. Today, we have a return guest, one of our favorite guests, and I don't like to play favorites, but this guy, well, people just love him. I've rerun his first episode several times, and this is going to be another total banger. It's going to become a greatest hit, an instantaneous greatest hit, because I have as my guest today, the one and only Bruce Feiler, who, as you will remember, wrote the book Life is in the Transitions. And his new book is called The Search, Finding Meaningful Work in a... And his new book is called The Search, Finding Meaningful Work in a Post-Career World. Now, Bruce is one of America's most thoughtful voices on contemporary life. He's the author of 7 New York Times bestsellers. Like I mentioned, Life is in the Transitions. Other books are The Secrets of Happy Families and The Council of Dads. His 3 TED Talks have been viewed more than 4 million times. That's impressive. His book that is out now, The Search, an instant classic, and it's a bold new roadmap for finding meaning and purpose at work based on insights drawn from hundreds of life stories from all vocations and backgrounds. I'll tell you something. I picked this book up. I read it. First of all, it's quick. Even though there's a lot, it's dense with information. It's like you just kind of race through it. I have recommended it to people. People read it and they thank me. You're just going to love Bruce. This is an amazing way about thinking about how we build our lives and our careers in a more complicated world, how we take big swings. This is going to get you fired up about making sure that you plot a path that is meaningful to you. It's just such a great way to think about careers. So we're going to jump right in now. As you know, I ask every guest the same question, and I started by asking Bruce this. Tell me something unexpected you learned about yourself that changed everything.
I'm going to buy time to answer that question by saying what a pleasure it is to talk to you. Mm-hmm. And I think back to the first conversation we had on this podcast, mm-hmm. What do we call them? And I can think of where I was, because it was the only interview I've ever done in that upstairs space. It was during the pandemic. And it was sort of, I hadn't really started talking about life transitions a lot the way I have done a lot in recent years. And yours was the first conversation. And I still hear from people about that conversation. Mm. And it's sort of, it's very embedded in that time when we were all being kind of thrust into one of these life transitions. And I sort of associate you in that moment. And then I'm grateful that our friendship has blossomed since then. And so now So in my mind, you're both a source of stability and a source of instability at the same time. And that's sort of how I think about you. I guess I want to say this. I learned that math and literature can play nicely together. Like I think that we grow up in a world, you know, my wife and I just sent identical twins to college. And one thing you send kids to college, like you quickly get thrust into this world of like distribution requirements, and they sort of divide things into math and science and language and humanities. And that's a sort of artificial construct that was invented a few hundred years ago, and it's kind of problematic in a lot of ways. But I guess, so if you met me in high school, I was sort of a math guy. And now that probably shocks you, but now I'm a story guy. But I think that these divisions don't work and that you can combine them. So when I think about telling a story now, I think every story should have some math in it. And I think in some ways it sort of captures the work that I'm doing now, but I think that's, yeah, that's what I think, that every day in our lives, we should blur some traditional distinction that divides us and see what comes out of it.
Oh, that's very thoughtful. I love it. And your last time, your last visit here to talk about life is in the transitions. That is, I think, my most recommended book. It may be my most repeated episode as my best of. So it's really good to have you back. And you wrote this new book. It's called The Search. The Search is a book that is about finding meaningful work in a post-career world. And I remember cracking this open and it was like, it just, there's so many truths in there that it was like to have them all in one place just felt like a luxury. Because what you're taking on is the fact that most people are very unhappy in their work. But, you know, instead of sort of writing a book that is like all the other books, you did what you do, which is you grounded it in the combination, just like you just said, of data and storytelling to get us to the other side of what is happening and to try to help us make meaning out of what we're doing in our careers. I want you to first, before we get into all of that, why don't you set the table and tell everybody what you found in terms of what is happening in careers today?
Well, for me, first of all, thank you for those kind comments. And maybe because that was one of the first conversations I had about it, it was real and raw and you asked such good questions. And maybe that's why it has resonated so deeply with people. But I started this work now 7 years ago. I mean, I had what I now think of as kind of linear life. Like I figured out what I wanted to do early in my life. I sold my first book 35 years ago as a young kid out of college, living in Japan, writing letters home on airmail paper. That's how old I am. And I wrote books about Japan and England and country music. I spent my 30s going back and forth to the Middle East, writing books about those conflicts. And I got married and I had children. And that's kind of the classic linear life, right? In the terms of your day job, right? That's the hockey stick. Like everything is growing exponentially on a linear path. But then in my 40s, my life blew up and I got cancer, as we've discussed, and I had financial troubles and my dad got very depressed with Parkinson's and tried to take his own life 6 times in 12 weeks. And that's what led me to what's now been, it's amazing because you and I have been on this journey together, 7 years, Patrick, of collecting and analyzing. I'm now close to 500 life stories, looking for patterns that can help us thrive in and survive in times of change. And so I wrote this book called Life is in the Transitions. I finished it in 2019. Everywhere I went, I said to people, why hasn't there been a major book on life transitions in 40 years? Like, why is no one talking about this? And everyone nodded politely and then went on with their day. And then the book, and then 2020 comes, and the entire planet is in a life transition at the same time. And so that book, we actually pulled it originally because it was supposed to be published in that spring, and we brought it out in that summer. And I mean, think about it, like that's the election, right? That's the pandemic, that social justice movement, all of these sources of turmoil. And the book just sort of like was the right book at the right time, right? It became a TED Talk and a TED course and sort of has taken on this life of its own. But it's very clear to me in that summer of 2020 that the next domino to fall is going to be work. Because what precipitates a change of the kind that we're now seeing in work is some pause, some disruptor, right? Some change that either we choose to or we are forced to kind of rethink or we reimagine what we do, right? So in life transitions, it becomes a life quake. And I start using this term in The Search of a work quake. So what the pandemic is this collective involuntary work quake where everybody is at the same time forced to rethink and reimagine what they do. And that opens the door to what has become now a series of phrases that have become very familiar that at the time were not known, right? The great resignation, the great relocation, right? A whole series of things. People are moving. They don't want to commute. The upshot of it is, right, which is the question you asked me, where are we today? We are today at a moment where 50 million Americans quit a job in the last year. That's in a workforce of 160 million people. So that's 30% of the workforce has quit in the last year. And number two, another third has said, I don't want to go into the office you know, 5 days a week if you're in a white-collar job, right? There's been this whole narrative, right? The companies are pushing back, like Facebook and Google are saying you must show up, but only 3 days a week. The idea of the five-day work week for the white-collar knowledge worker is a thing of the past. But collectively, you add those two things together, that's two-thirds of the workforce. That's 100 million Americans who will sit down with someone they love tonight, tomorrow, this weekend, next year, and say, honey, I'm not happy with what I'm doing. I want to do something that makes me happy. And that's the moment we're in, but that's also the crisis that we're in. Because we have talked about work exclusively for a century only in terms of math, right? Numbers, profit, salary, benefit, right? Everything has been about using a metric of numbers to quantify how we think about work and success. But in overemphasizing numbers, we've underestimated words, right? Too much math, not enough poetry. And what people want is meaningful work, but we have not given them the tools to identify that. And that's the gap that this sort of became very clear to me. And so what I've tried to do in the interviews I've conducted in this space and now in the search is to give people a mechanism to ask what turns out to be the hardest question of all. What do I want to do? What work would make me happy? What is it that gives me meaning right now? Which is almost assuredly different from 6 months ago or 6 years ago or 25 years ago when you started working full-time.
FOMO.
Tudo bem, meus queridos FOMO sapiens? Now that right there was Portuguese, and as you know, I love speaking foreign languages. But I'm not alone. One in five Americans have learned a new language on their bucket list. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off that list with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Now, FOMO sapiens, you know I speak four languages, and it takes work to stay on top of them, especially with French. C'est difficile. But with Babbel, I'm able to practice practical conversations that I can actually use in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/FOMO. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/FOMO. That's spelled BABBEL.com/FOMO. Rules and restrictions may apply. Tell me if this sounds familiar. Your business gets to a certain size and the cracks start to emerge. Things you used to do in a day are taking a week. You don't have one source of truth. If this is you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000. That's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25. NetSuite turns 25 this year. Happy birthday. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close the books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. One, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs. Those are key performance indicators in one efficient system. Now, FOMO sapiens, you know the show is all about making better decisions. And with this product, you can make better decisions because you have all the information you need right in one place. Right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/FOMO. That's netsuite.com/FOMO to get your own KPI checklist. Because you know what? KPIs are better than ice cream. netsuite.com/FOMO.
FOMO.
What's so interesting as I think about the world of work is I look at my peer group, who are all people that 50 years ago coming out of an MBA program would have gotten a job at a bank or some big company and stayed there for their entire career. And now I look around and as I talk to my classmates, we're coming up on 20 years out. Most people don't work in corporate settings. Some do, many do, but many don't. And a lot of people have been through big transitions, work quakes, where they, number one, they feel embarrassed or ashamed. Number two, they ask themselves, like, I did all the right things, and yet I have no clue. I'm supposed to, you know, if I can't figure it out, right? And they feel alone in that. And I'm always amazed. I'm like, you feel alone? Like, I can tell you 15 other people I've talked to who feel exactly that way. Now, you have this quote that I read that I really like. You say, the big insight that you learned while working on the project is that the people who are happiest to work don't just climb, they also dig. There is a personal archaeology. So I'd love to start there because, you know, so much of what creating change in ourselves or knowing where we go is about going inside and doing inner work, right? So talk about that perspective and how that informs the work that you've been doing.
I do want to address the thing that you're hearing from your classmates before I answer that
question,
if I might. Because what I've now learned in the going on 4 years that I've been talking about these kinds of life transitions publicly, there's a kind of technical reaction to my work. It's a scientific term that you may not understand, Patrick. And the scientific term is, whew, people say when they hear me talk about this, it's like, oh my God, thank God. Like you're putting words to something that I'm feeling that I didn't know that I was feeling.
Yeah.
Like the whole big idea that I've been talking about now for years, right? Which is that the linear life is dead and it's been replaced by a non-linear life. Puts a language to something that there has not been a language. My wife, Linda, whom you know, and I think is how you and I met each other, she likes to say that I have hard knowledge about soft things. And I have math applied to feelings, to go to the theme now, I guess, what will be the theme of this conversation, and the brilliant way you structure these things. But so you're not alone. I mean, like the three most powerful words in the English language that what you should say to yourself and to anyone you know going through a difficult time is you're not alone. You're not alone. Two-thirds of the country is feeling what you're feeling. I'm off track. I'm off kilter. I'm off schedule. Like the life I'm living is not the life I expected to be living. And here's the thing. The problem is not you. It's your expectations. That's the big message here, okay? You're not doing anything wrong. It's that what you expected to happen was the lie. And that's the thing. Like we have the line from, you've just quoted me the line from The Search that's quoted to me most often. The line from Life is in the Transitions that's quoted to me so often, most often is we have linear expectations but nonlinear lives. Like we are haunted by the ghost of linearity. And so what your classmates are saying to you is, I bought into this narrative in some textbook or something I heard from my mother about a midlife crisis. And like, it doesn't follow. My crisis is not on that schedule because no one's crisis is on that schedule because that schedule was a lie. So now you turn to work, right? The predominant narrative that we've talked about work going back in this country to Benjamin Franklin is all about up. Up by your bootstraps, rags to riches, big, higher floor, bigger office, better view, more benefits. And we have been told that how we should pursue our work is all about following these linear constructs, right? Climb the ladder, okay? Ride the escalator. Everyone that you can think of is linear. That's a completely artificial idea. For most of human history, there was no word for career because there was no need for a career. Most people lived where they worked and worked where they lived, okay? Like it took 90% of the people 90% of the time to produce food to feed the planet, okay? So people tended the farm, right? And they made their own candles and they tended their own sick and they educated their own young and they cared for their own elderly. It wasn't until the birth of the Industrial Revolution, in the 20th century that people began to change, right? And so they moved in large numbers from rural areas to the cities, okay? Like I was on TV recently and someone said, can you believe 4,500 people lost their job last month to AI? And I was like, 4,500? You know how many people lost their lives, lost their jobs in the Industrial Revolution? A third of the country. Yeah. A third of the country leaves a rural area and goes to the city. And now you have all these people in the city with nothing to do and new industries with no one to hire. And so a guy named Frank Parsons in 1908 invents the idea of a career, put these people in a room, ask them a series of questions once, if they were men in their 20s, and say, what do you want to do? And then go say, do this for the next 50 years of your life. Well, that was just not how we live today. That was the idea that in the beginning of the 20th century. Then the next big invention in work, when we move from the factory floor to the office floor, is the resume. No one had ever needed a resume before 1950. So the resume becomes popular. What is the resume? A linear construct. Each job is supposed to be bigger and higher and more important, with more, kind of responsibilities. And that's the expectation. That no longer reflects how we live today. Half of us don't even have a main job anymore. And we can get into all of that. But what is that? That is a linear construct. And it's all about up. But I'm here to tell you, as you just said, quoted The Search, the people who are happiest and most fulfilled don't just climb, they also dig. Okay. They do what I call personal archaeology. They dig deep into themselves and into their past, into their present, into their future, and say, who am I? What is the story that I want to tell? And how can I tell that story now? I mean, just go back to that escalator just briefly. I'm old enough that women of my generation were told, if you get off the escalator and spend time with your children, you'll never get back on the escalator. I mean, I'm dead serious when I say this. Nothing has squandered more human potential in history. I even think maybe more than war. Like, that is to tell half the population that you must follow this artificial path of up the escalator. That's ridiculous. So we've stigmatized, and in fact, we need to renormalize spending time with your children, running for office, you know, starting a venture that may fail, writing a book, you know, running for public office, whatever it might be. You can do whatever you want, whenever you want it. We have 20 work quakes in the course of our lives, and the problem is no one's given us the questions to ask, and that's what I've tried to do. This is how to give yourself this meaning audit to determine what it is that you want to be doing right now.
It's really interesting to think about the fact, I mean, you're right, the entire construct, which was, you know, and it's like also the, in America, I think also culturally, there is this whole narrative that we are captive to, we are prisoners to, that forces us into that paradigm. And as a result, you can see, obviously, the stats are there. People are unhappy in their work. And we're living in a time where things are changing very rapidly, and you simply cannot play the same old game. And that's why so many people, again, feel lost. Now, you give us in the book, you give us a recipe to do that kind of work, to go within. And like, having been forced to do this myself against my own will when my whole career blew up in the financial crisis and I ended up on a heart monitor, whoops. I loved reading that because it's sort of like, oh, I did that. Some of these things, I didn't do that thing. I wish I had done that thing. But it's sort of like, when you put it in the terms that you do, you are giving that person who is looking, you are giving them the steps they need to follow. So let's talk about some of that stuff. You know, you talk about the sort of three standards. I'd love to just give people a sense of what are the steps they can start to take so they get a sense of what's in the book.
Yeah. So first of all, you're not alone. You say 70%, you know, people are not happy. Let's put something, 70% of people are not happy with their work. That's 100 million people, okay? So that's 2 million people, you know, I mean, that's 2 million people a week who are going to say, I'm unhappy. Like, that's an astonishing number.
And that's just in the U.S.
And yeah, that's just in the U.S., exactly. And internationally, you know, we see similar trends. Okay, so now what? Okay, now what are you going to do? Okay, so what I'm advocating is that you do what the people who find happy, who are happy, which is you start asking yourself what would make you happy. And so I think that there's two different sort of ways of thinking about this. The core exercise, right? One is, you know, what is it that gives you meaning, right? I have this idea that appears now in both books called the ABCs of meaning. That's what gives us meaning. The A is agency, right? What we do or make or build or create. Okay, for many of us, it's our work. The B is belonging, our friends, our relationships, our loved ones, our people we play pickleball with or, you know, march in rallies with. And the C is a cause, a calling, something higher than yourself. So what happens in these moments is that we all have these ABCs within us and we sort of allot them a certain way. And what happens in a workquake is that we begin to kind of rethink or reimagine or revisit the balance, right? So maybe we've been working very hard and we say we want to spend more time with our family, or maybe we've been caring for young children or aging relatives and we want to start working again, or maybe we've been giving back and we're burned out and we want to do something to make money. So the key thing to realize is that any decision you make, you're going to revisit in 2.5 years. That's the number of work weeks that we have on average. And for young people, it's even faster. A millennial woman will make these decisions, right? 60% faster than her boomer mom will have made them, okay? So let's just go back to the money, you know, versus meaning conversation, right? So maybe you're at a moment in your life where you want to make money or need to make money because you have college debt, right? Or in my case, you're sending two kids to college. The key to remember is you're not making this decision forever because it might change, okay? Maybe your point where you've been prioritizing making money and now you want to prioritize belonging, relationships, right? So spending less time, maybe not commuting, being able to coach Little League or, you know, go to the travel soccer game or watch your kid in a ballet performance. So maybe you're going to do something for a while, but in the nonlinear work life that we're in, that's now acceptable. No decision is forever. You're going to constantly revisit this, and the stigma attached with changing. You know, let's just talk about entrepreneurship, something you know well, right? So, because one of the three lies about work is that you have a job. Because no, you don't have a job. Like there are five types of jobs, actually. You may have five jobs. One is a main job. But as I said a few seconds ago, half of us don't even have a main. Think about that. Half of us don't even have a main job anymore.
That's incredible. Okay.
There's a care job, like caring for relatives or neighbors or friends or whatever it might be. There's a side job, which we hear about a lot. Three quarters of us have one of those. But there's also two different kinds of jobs that I have named now in the search. One is a hope job, which is something that you're doing that you hope leads to something else, right? Like working on a screenplay or selling, you know, pickles at the farmer's market, or in the case of my friend Patrick, you know, running a podcast. And most entrepreneurships begin as hope jobs. But so here's now you start to think about it different. Maybe you have a main job that you're doing for salary and benefits while you're starting a hope job on the side that maybe will lead to something. Maybe you've discovered that babies don't, you know, need a different kind of Jessica Alba, you know, need non-allergenic shampoo, right? Or maybe you discover that, you know, you have an idea from your main job at, was it DuPont, where the person who ends up WD-40, you know, takes it home and there's the 40th formula to come up with WD-40. Like, so maybe you have a hope job or a side job. And then that's going to take over and you're going to start a company or an organization. And then, but that's your side job or hope job. And then you switch, but you're still not making the money. So your hope job or your side job becomes your money job, right? To pay the bills. Like I talked to a guy, right? He was Korean American. He was a lawyer because that was the traditional path. And he went to Goldman Sachs to become a lawyer. But his toothache, like the thing that's been nagging at him since he was a kid, one of my questions is, what's your toothache? Was he grew up as a first-generation immigrant sharing a bathroom with three sisters. And like, so he spent a lot of time thinking about bathrooms. He starts a hope job of a design business of redoing his friends' kitchens and bathrooms. And then he gets to the point where he wants to start his own design firm, which he does. But he still can't pay the bills, so he takes a side job as a lawyer. So you see, the opportunity of this new nonlinear life is you can cobble. What's non-negotiable is the meaning. Everything else is negotiable now. That's the flip from the last 100 years, where for the most of the last 100 years, it was stability is the most important thing. And your meaning was far second or tertiary. Now the meaning is most important, and how you cobble together the money, the benefits, the purpose, the meaning, the giving back, that's, it's harder. And that's why my book has these 21 questions to find work you love, because the hardest part is figuring out what is that you want to do, not what you have been told your whole life that you should do. Get off the should train. Get on the want train. That's the most important thing, and that's the hardest thing.
FOMO. Tell us a story that shows that. I think a person who did that process and what it did, that transformative activity of thinking through this, somebody who maybe externally looked really happy, but found something much more meaningful. What was that process and what was the outcome?
Let me do two quickly. The first is Tim Pierpont. Mm-hmm. Tim Pierpont is born in New England, Connecticut, not your beloved Maine.
It's not as nice.
He's always drawn to his hands. He likes working with art and he likes experimenting. Like his favorite childhood experience was like painting the fence. His parents like, no, you need a traditional job. Like you can't work with your hands in this neighborhood. Like that's not acceptable. So he goes to college, he gets an engineering degree. Again, he opens a painting company. His friends like, apparently you can't do that. So he follows his girlfriend to California. He goes to work in a ski shop. He meets a customer and he goes to work in for a bank. In their commercial real estate, like designing their various offices, where he stays for the next 25 years. One day, the guy sitting next to him, it looks a little sick. The boss says, go home. A year later, he dies. And Tim Pierpont goes and he sits down in a Starbucks and he does this meaning audit. He doesn't call it a meaning audit because that's the term that I've later applied to it. He says, what are the five things I would be doing right now that would make me the most happy? I'd be outdoors. I'd be working with my hands. I'd be helping the neighborhood. And he's like, if I was painting, I would be doing all those things. So he leaves his corporate job. He opens a company called Pierpont Painting. And oh my God, I'm now realizing I met him because of some people that you put me in touch with in Silicon Valley.
What?
Who were doing a cancer charity. You may remember. I remember his wife was on this thing. That's how I met him.
Wow.
And he tells me, and she tells me the story. Like, I'm in a neighborhood where everyone's got a Tesla, and I'm the only one with my business painted on the side of a van.
Wow.
And like, I'm totally shamed by this experience, but he's happy. And then the kicker to this story is he learns around this time, that he's adopted, and he can now track down his birth mother, and he tracks down his birth mother and finds out that she's an artist. And so suddenly his entire life makes sense. Wow. That this creativity is inside of him. So that's one story. Wow. The second story, if I can do another one briefly, yeah, in the time that we have, is Maroy Park. She grows up, also a first generation East Asian in the Northwest. Her 16th birthday present from her father is a chemistry textbook. Mm. If you've ever gotten a statement from your, you know, immigrant families that there's an expected path that you should take, she's like, I don't want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a chemist. You know, I want to serve the country. So she travels to the West. She goes to college in Washington, D.C. She takes the Foreign Service exam, and as she says, I pick the name brand. And she goes to work for the CIA. And she is assigned to the Soviet desk, at the time the premier, most prestigious job in intelligence, probably on the planet, in the American, you know, the Soviet desk of the CIA in Virginia. And she hates it. And she says, you know what? She said, there's two sides. There's like the spooks, and then there's like the logistics people. And she says, you know, I think that I can make a greater impact on the logistics side. So she leaves the Soviet desk to run payroll for the CIA, like the least distinguished job imaginable, like in the U.S. government. And from there, she's invited to run HR. And from there, she goes abroad and runs the Moscow embassy. She then rises to the executive underneath the leader. And she in time becomes the head of the entire CIA, the first Asian American woman to hold this job. And what do these stories have in common? These stories have in common what all work stories involving happiness have in common. What appears on the surface to be the unright choice.
Mm.
It's not the wrong choice, but it feels like the unright choice. Your decision disappoints somebody, your spouse, your parents, your colleagues, guy who's a telephone repairman for 25 years and puts his retirement to become a women's shoe designer. Like, his colleagues are like, what the, you know, are you doing? They have the unright choice to others turns out to be the right choice for ourselves. And it's the courage to make that choice is the precondition to being happy at work.
Oh, man, those stories have me fired up. I love it so much because it is, you've seen, and we've all had that friend who did that thing, who figured it out did it. And then you know what happens? We watch them and we're happy for them, but we know, we say to ourselves, well, I'd love to do that. I'd love to figure that. I don't know how.
Oh, yeah. I can't do that. I got to pay the bills.
And you are giving us the book. Yeah. I mean, that's why I love The Search. When I read it, I was like, thankfully, I did this the hard way. But, you know, it's like, it really is powerful. Now, I do want to ask you, before we get to lightning round questions, I do want to ask you one last question, which is this. A lot of people who listen to this show, they are managers or owners of businesses or entrepreneurs. So they have people who are working for them. And let's just say, despite their best, like, nobody wants to have unhappy people working for them. They don't want to be like, you know what, people on my team, I'll hate their job. Of course not. But we've just heard the stats. So let's, you know, everybody just don't be fooled into thinking you're the one who's avoided this situation. What can leaders of businesses do to make meaning for their employees?
This is such a good— this is such a good question. Okay, I'm fortunate now to have this platform and talking to a lot of businesses, and because this is the leadership challenge of the moment. Mm-hmm. And here's how I frame it. Okay, we just talked about the first conversation we had on FOMO Sapiens was at the beginning of the pandemic. At the beginning of when we talked in the spring of 2020, the Employee Well-Being Office in any organization was in the cellar in a windowless, cinder block room next to the incinerator. Like, that's how people valued it. And if there's a change in American business and global you know, understanding of work in the last 3.5 years is that that office is no longer in the basement in a windowless cinder block room. It's on every floor. It's in every conversation. Because what people have realized is there's no more stigma against quitting your job. So what I'm talking about is how the employees are thinking about meaning, okay? And that's happening. You can put your head in the sand and you're going to find that they're going to leave. Or you can do what is now called for, which is that you need a meaning agenda, okay? You need a strategy for talking about a meaning in the workplace and how you are going to be responsive. So that begins, interestingly enough, with the same process. It begins with a meaning audit. Like, let's do an analysis. Let's actually talk to people. What are we doing in our workplace that's working or not working to give people the meaning that they are craving? Because now we know if they don't have this meaning, they're going to leave because there's no longer a stigma. They can get off the escalator and the penalty is not anywhere near as severe as it used to be. So first, you do your own meaning audit in your organization. Then what you need to do is you need to start using the language of meaning, right? You know, you can devote time to every meeting. You can have time to every week because if you don't talk about it in set aside places, you'll be talking about it in every place and then your business isn't functioning. Okay, so you need to schedule time. So what we've learned from Agile. This is what's in my book on happy families. It's like you're going to have to be Agile. You're going to have to find a language that brings meaning into the workplace. Okay, and then you're going to need, you know, a set of things that you can do. And there's a lot out there. Some of them are in my book. I wrote a white paper for TED about this, for TED at Work. So the point is, you need to say, we are going to address employee well-being, you know, flexibility. We're going to address the work hours. We're going to address the, you know, when we send emails, how we talk about mental health, how we buddy up a system, how we onboard people in a hybrid world. So all of these things are going to be part of it. But the way to think about it is a meaning agenda in your workplace that will address the now non-negotiable, as I said a few minutes ago, meaning agenda of your workers, or else they're going to leave and you're going to be looking for someone else and then you're going to be bogged down looking for people. You're much better off meeting the people that you already have rather than trying to go find new people every 6 months.
And you will learn so much that'll make you so much better. That's what I love about it. Like, you're just going to be getting data and you're going to make it. That's really cool. Okay. So let us move on to the lightning round because
I know. Okay. I told you before we went in the air, you know, I can't, as we've just learned on this podcast,
we've scheduled 30 minutes for the lightning round.
My voice in less than 90 seconds. Yeah, exactly.
All right. This is good. All right. Number one, what is a favorite quote?
I've just done the worst thing possible in the answer to this question, which I've thought of a quote of mine.
That's okay.
Which is the thing that I have written that is most quoted back to me. Someone sent me a picture this week of it in a cafe in Amsterdam. Athens, Greece. Take a walk with the turtle. Behold the world in pause. Comes from when I was in cancer and on crutches and I had to slow down for 2 years. And you slow down, you hurry to a place, you get there on time. Mm. But you get there alone, you slow down, you get there with other people. In France, gentlemen of leisure used to take a walk with a turtle to show that they were men of leisure. Take a walk with a turtle. Behold the world in pause.
So good. All right. That was long, but I loved it. Number two.
I know.
Name a book that every FOMO sapiens should read. Not one of yours, though. A different one. We've already read all yours.
The Other Side of Sorrow. By George Bonanno. It's a kind of a groundbreaking, genre-changing way of thinking about sadness and grief. Bust the five stages of grief and shows actually that most of us respond effectively to grief if we respond effectively.
Oh, that's fantastic. Number three, what's one piece of advice you give to your younger self?
Take the trip. If you have time and money and health, take the trip.
Yeah.
I've had more trips canceled for those. The older you get, the greater the chances that one of those will interfere. you don't have the time, you don't have the money. I can't tell you the number of trips that got canceled because someone, either I or someone I know in my family on the party got sick. I have a big trip coming up with my in-laws that was almost canceled for illness. Take the trip.
That's a good one. Final one. You know I love that one. Final one. What's your most important memory?
That is an amazing question. I don't think you asked me that question.
That's Charles Duhigg gave that to me, I believe.
I like Charles.
Yeah.
I like Charles Duhigg. It's funny enough because the last thing I did before the lockdown actually was be on his podcast. That was done in person, right? You and I have done two of these not in person. Say the question again because I had the answer.
What's your most important memory? Thanks, Charlie.
I'm going to say creating the Council of Dads. 3 days after I got diagnosed with cancer as the parent of 3-year-old twin daughters, I had the idea to reach out to a group of friends to be present in the lives of my daughters in case that I died. And the reason I think it's the most important memory, it's because it was the bottom of my life. It was the worst week of my life. It was the time I was most scared and vulnerable and ashamed and afraid. And I reached out to other people, and I like what that tells me about myself. And so that when I go through a difficult time again, I want to remember that instinct of when I feel tired or scared or alone or ashamed, I want to reach out to others. So creating the Council of Dads.
I'll tell you something, everybody. If you don't know the Council of Dads story, it's a book. I first encountered it as a podcast, and I knew Linda, Bruce's wife, but I didn't know Bruce. I knew who he was. And I listened to it. I was on a work trip to the Caribbean, not so bad. And it was the Saturday. I was at the pool and I was listening to The Moth and you came on.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was at the pool and I was sobbing. People were looking over like, what happened to that man? It really, and then it turned into a TV show, which I also watched, which unfortunately in the show, the dad does not live. Now that show was like a total tearjerker. I cried my way through the first, I wish it was. So anyway, that for me is a beautiful story that everybody should spend time with because it is, I don't know, it gets me. So thank you for saying that because I'm glad that people are going to hear about that today. All right. So if you want to find more about Bruce, you're going to head over to his website. It's brucefeiler.com. You're going to find him on Instagram and Twitter at Bruce Feiler. He's on LinkedIn. He's on Facebook. The man is everywhere. Bruce Feiler, author of The Search and many other books. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. And thank you for this space you created and for all the things you do. I hear from your listeners all the time and for your friendship now over many years. It's always a pleasure, Patrick.
Thank you. FOMO. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick J. McGinnis, on Twitter at PJ McGinnis, and on the web at FOMOsapiens.com or PatrickMcGinnis.com, where you can get all kinds of free resources to live a more decisive and entrepreneurial life. FOMO Sapiens is recorded in New York City. Theme music is by Mike McGinnis and editing and post-production is by Josh Elstro. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me at FOMOsapiens.com and at PatrickMcGinnis.com. To advertise on FOMO Sapiens, reach out to contact@FOMOsapiens.com.